Michael's going to show a video now about Rio. After that, we will open up to a roundtable format where we'll continue the interactive discussion. I'll tell you more about that after Michael's video.
It's not a video, it's a presentation.
Presentation, beg your pardon.
With a video.
Cidade maravilhosa,
cheia de encantos mil.
Cidade maravilhosa, coração do meu Brasil.
Cidade maravilhosa, cheia de encantos mil. Cidade maravilhosa, coração do meu Brasil.
Did is he jumped right to the end of my presentation. That's very good. Thanks very much. Listen, it's been great hearing. First of all, good afternoon, or is it good afternoon? I think it is. It's been great hearing all week, or the last 2 days, about Rio. Speaking to Matthew and to Ben, I said, give us a chance. Just, you know, who went to Rio here? Quite a few of you. What a magnificent place, isn't it? Just like your hometown. But we are here ready today just a little bit to tell you about how we are ready and how we want your business. This is very important. I'm trying to take on a quick journey. I have 8 minutes. I won't sit here and tell you who we are, that we are a private enterprise that work only for the public, for the private sector. And we work together with the government to make things happen. Independently, whether government stay or not, we continue. Everything began back in 2014. Obviously, you had the IOC doing their thing, Rio 2016 doing theirs. And we were concerned about looking to the future. So in 2014, we did an event and we invited London and Barcelona to come and tell us what not to do. And basically, we spent the first 2 years preparing ourselves within the market, trying to get players who can actually buy us and help us grow post-Olympics. And that event was Rio 2017, A Future of Opportunities. Very focused at the events and tourism segment in total. And today, we're actually participating here, and one of the reasons we're here, this project becomes Rio 2020, which is we want to have 20 calendar events that will sustain Rio's hospitality. And the whole product, when we say cadeia de turismo, be it the hotels, the airlines, the restaurants, we want the whole system to take benefit. Like Rotterdam, we want the events that come to stay, not the one-shot options. One-shot options are good, but pay to play. But you're coming to stay, Rio's open arms and ready to make things happen. That's what it's all about, the legacy that everybody talks about. Obviously, the airport of Rio de Janeiro is brand new, a PPP, a public-private partnership. And this was key for us. Today, Rio is connected to 80 countries worldwide and through São Paulo to another 110. I'm going to tell a little story now. As I said, you know, we had the World Cup. You all saw it. But Rio's special about special things happening. And we won't mention to the Germans how well you played 7-1. We won't go there. It wasn't a good one. But Rio and Brazil have things happen for a reason. And the World Cup was essential. We are one of the best football teams in the world. And second time we have the World Cup, final, Germany against Argentina. Now, could you imagine what it would be for us if Argentina won? So anyway, not even the best script writer could have done this. While the World Cup's going on, I don't know if you all remember, and I'm telling you the story because I'm going to end up at the Olympics. 49th minute, an Argentinian, un hermano, as we say, decides to invade the pitch. And FIFA, who is so fantastic, decides to pull away and not show it as they do, as you all know. And this was actually happening. This happened around the world. And this is important because, like the Olympics, like we've heard this week from Sir Craig and many others, and the gentleman from the federations, how Rio sustained nearly 600 more athletes than the IOC were ready to do. Special things happen for your events in Rio. And this is something iconic that the world saw. Let's go to Rio 2016. We are in the home of golf called Scotland, and I'd like you all to know that Rio is now the home of Olympic golf. So you can all bring it. This was a special moment for us. What happened with the Olympics? It helped us redesign the city. There was infrastructure done, for those of you who saw it, who didn't see it, that helped us find this new city that we don't actually have a history, how we're going to fill and do all work these destinations, because this was all built up from the World Cup to the Olympics. Infrastructure was ready. We didn't have to build much more than we already had. But this left us with a destination that offers you and your events four unique destinations in one city. Venues that are ready, tested, proved to work. We are here in the room. I don't know if you realize, but there are three Brazilian ladies. Obviously, I'm the only man from Brazil. We have Milena, who runs the Rio Centro. For those of you, she's waving her hand there for you. For those of you who saw the boxing, who saw the ping pong and other sports, they did it all. These venues that are staying after, they're actually probably going to be administrating them, taking them forward. So infrastructure is there for whatever size event you have. We have Mrs. Agnes. Raise your hand, Agnes, please. This is the young lady and her company, Planeta Brazil and Match, put together the World Cup and a lot of hospitality during the Olympics. There is a lot of experience here in Brazil and Rio especially. And we have Andrea, who's my boss, who's sitting over there, who takes care of the Rio Convention Bureau. Now, what was best about this was today we actually have a joke. We say Rio's the most European city in South America because we have the metro systems. Simple things that for you here in Europe are normal, but for us they came off the paper that were 70-year projects that should have been done 70 years ago. And because of the World Cup and because of the Olympics, they made a difference. Now, that cost a lot of money, but we needed this to happen. And this was essential for us. So today, the logistics of getting our Rio spectacular. I can tell you, we've gained an hour and a half a day just because of everything that's happened. But I must say, we were under construction for nearly 9 years. So that was tough. And these kind of things happen, like this area I'm showing you here. And this is a mural, for those of you who saw it, it's 400 meters long. It's in the Guinness Book of Records. This whole area here and the mobility we have, the Boulevard Olímpico, during the Olympics, we're receiving around 2 million people a day. The dynamics of the city allow us to do this, which is very good. Now, this was one of the legacies we had. We had 26,000 rooms when we came to the World Cup, and we were considered the most expensive city in the world because there was more demand than there was availability. As you heard yesterday, and you all know, Brazil entered the World Cup, small little economic crisis hit the world and us, which we were actually living through all the other economic crises going around the world. Brazil were ahead of the game. And we were left now with a lot of hotel rooms. We went from 26,000 to 42,000 hotel rooms. If I add on posadas, bed and breakfasts, and hostels, we have 62,000. And we won't talk about those people called Airbnb, who caused a lot of damage. So dynamics of availability of hospitality and rooms in Rio, you have no problem. The volunteership we did in Rio, over 30,000 people did this. The involvement we have from local community is huge. And this is great when you have events that need this kind of support. We know we have the experience with the World Cup and the Olympics, how to make things happen and put them together. Again, the diversity of rooms through each region are fantastic. We went from 6 five-star hotels to 26 five-star hotels. And the 4 and 3-star options are fantastic enough to help make your events viable in Rio de Janeiro. Obviously, the ability to handle, everybody was concerned with the Paralympics. Paralympics, huge success again. As you saw yesterday, Professor Unger was telling us the magnificent games in the magnificent city and the biggest event of all time in Olympic history. So we know how to do whatever kind of event we need, and the infrastructure is there. Again, the dynamics of the number of hotel brands we have make it easy. Special moments happened in Rio. The GB team was mentioned today. Well, at this tennis court, Andy Murray had his second Olympic gold, and he's currently the number one in the world. But we know how to handle sports events and all kinds of events in Rio. Again, this is important. If you look here now, the same map with a little few dots, and if I can somehow get up there. Excuse me. So we have downtown, two spaces with 9,850 rooms, with a local airport, and two spaces to stage any event. Obviously, iconic Rio Ipanema Copacabana Leblon, lots of hotels and space. But this is the great asset we gained in Rio de Janeiro. As I said, Milena, with the biggest convention center in South America, but only as an exhibition hall, the Dynamics Hotel inside the convention center, 2,600 rooms just around the hotel, plus the Dynamics that they have an amphitheater and all the space available. And then we have hotels with space that can make your events happen. This is one of the big legacies we have, and a legacy that's available to you. Why am I going backwards? Obviously, building infrastructure, making it ready, making it happen. I think we showed the world we know how to do it. Something else, you actually can ride your bicycle from 43 kilometers along the beach in Rio de Janeiro. Not many cities can do that on a waterfront. And these are dynamics and interactions that bring your events and help your people actually and your participants actually participate inside the event and live the city as it is. As I said, the home of Olympic golf. This is something special for us. Brazil, Rio has 3 golf courses. Brazil has 127, very few for the country the size we are. But Rio now has a product which is actually the only effective Olympic venue that actually brings tourists directly because of its existence. And we tend to take advantage of this. And we are bidding for many golf events, and we are open for many corporate events itself. The video was supposed to be at the end, so I'll jump over. This is me did I do it in time? Because you've been watching your watch. Listen, the Olympics, the World Cup, the Pope, the Pan American Games, literally we've done a lot. And we do it hard, we work hard. We are not embarrassed to fix what needs to be done. We've shown the world we know how to do it. We're far away from Europe, I agree. But we have a lot of partnerships with over 17 airline companies to make your events better. We have the highest professionals possible who've done the events, like Milena, like Agnes, like Andrea. They've been doing this for years. We know how to do it. We are open for business. We want to be with you for the next 10, 20 years. Please come to Rio, look us up. We want your events. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much, Michael. Great to hear more about Rio from Rio itself after Mr. Uwe's excellent presentation from the IOC perspective yesterday. As I mentioned earlier on, the final session of the conference, is a round table which will focus on bidding and hosting opportunities firstly, and followed by opportunities in delivery and legacy. And the key word here is opportunities, and it's an opportunity for you all to share your thoughts, experiences, and most of all, if you have opportunities that you can share with the room to talk about opportunities for your colleagues to get involved in your city, in your event, your projects. Very much welcome you to share those thoughts with us. The session will be led by Rick Treyer from the Canadian Sports Tourism Alliance. And we have a distinguished set of panellists who will lead the discussion that will then follow with interactive comments, questions, and observations from the floor. Thank you very much. And thank you, Rick. Ian Hooper, thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Ben. It's my pleasure to introduce our panel for today, beginning with on my far left, Ian Hooper, who's the Director of Sport with Glasgow Life. Mr. Jani Leskinen, who's the CEO of Lahti 2017, the Nordic World Ski Championships, an event that's celebrating 100-year anniversary of the city
of Finland.
Excuse me, and finally Tarantil Meshkikirovyev. He's the CEO of Transport Directorate for the FIFA World Cup Russia 2018. And if you'll just bear with us, Tarantil has a flight to catch at 1:30 today, so he's asked to go first. So we're going to jump right in and allow Tarantil to explain, I guess, the experience of Sochi 2014 from a transport standpoint and how it is transitioning into the plans for 2018 FIFA World Cup.
Thank you very much, and first of all, I would like to thank our hosts for such a great event. It was very interesting and useful conference. I'm very sorry because of this time schedule for the plane, and I will just tell you a few words how it works in Russia from the point of legacy. It's a little bit more than 2 years ago, we have this Winter Olympics in Sochi. It was a lot of discussion about the infrastructure, investment, and actually the whole city was totally renovated. And we get the, we built a new airport, new railroads, completely new infrastructure. If you come to Sochi, if you've been there like say 10 years ago and you come now, it's two different cities. And what is more interesting from the transport point of view is that we, during the Winter Olympics, we have something like 40,000, it was a peak record, it was 40,000 people a day who were using the airport in Sochi. And this year, it's the first time for this city that we increased it. So we have like the capacity of the airport, the number of passengers arriving there every day is more than on the peak hour of the Olympic game. So we have more passengers on the 2016 already than we have it on 2014 when we have it Olympic games. It means that the new infrastructure brings more people to the city, and it's the hotel capacity. It's difficult to book a hotel there, and it's during the winter season. It's the ski sector is completely full. It's a very convenient transportation now. It takes us less than 1 hour to come from the plane and to the top mountain, and. Returning to the FIFA World Cup, which we will have in the 2018, I would like to mention two I think, quite important things which will help. I don't want to talk about the infrastructure itself, that we are building a new airport, like with new Sheremetyevo airport with more than 16 million passengers a year, would be accomplished by 2018. We built a new airport in Rostov-on-Don from the greenfield for 5 million passengers. But I think that it's one of the most important tasks for us from the legacy point of view is to increase the mobility of the people. And if we compare Russia with a similar country as in the land as the United States or Canada, for instance, we see that the number of kilometers per person it's 4 times less. So it's a low mobility in our economy, and it's not very good for economy itself. And I could say that from a historical point of view, let's say that a little bit more than 100 years ago, if we take the end of the 19th century, that 95% of all the population spent all their life in the range of the 50 miles from the place of the birth. So it was like the very unmobile world. Mm-hmm. And we see that the dramatically increase in the quality of life is also because of the transportation and increase in mobility. And we will invent two things. It's the first time during the World Cup we will provide free intercity rail transport for all ticket holders. So if you buy a ticket, just a regular ticket, not some it's just regular ticket on very cheap, on the cheap, best price, we will provide you with a free interrail. And from Moscow to St. Petersburg, from Moscow to Sochi, with a comfortable and where there is a high-speed rail, we'll provide you with a high-speed rail. And we expect that more than 1 million people will use this service. And the second thing is, it's not new, but we will provide the free transportation for the public transport in the cities. And we want to accomplish two things. First, with the free public transport in the cities, it's not only to have a good transport for the World Cup itself, but we want also to switch people from cars to the public transport. And we think that it will be very good legacy if the people who, the last time probably they used the public transport something like 20 or 30 years ago, will use it to see that it's relevant, it's comfortable, it's faster than to use a car. And we think that we will increase the number of people who will use public transport after the World Cup, and it's one point of legacy. And the second one, with the intercity travel, we will have 11 cities with a distance between its 3,000 kilometers from Kaliningrad to Yekaterinburg. It's a similar distance as from Moscow to London, almost. And we see that we will want people to move across the country, which very good point just to come to the city, you know, probably it's not very far away from you, spend there a day or two, return back, and we want to increase the mobility. And we also think that the World Cup is a great opportunity to encourage and inspire people to travel. And we think it would be, beside this, a capital investment in the infrastructure, it will be the great legacy which we will have in Russia. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thanks very much, Taran Teel. And as I said, he has to leave. He has a flight to catch. We'll continue on. And perhaps, Yanni,
you could tell us about the exciting event that's coming up in Lodi in 2017, and perhaps walk us through the bid process that that allowed you to secure the event, and then some of the special elements that you're planning to create a specific theme around the event.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, basically, in our case, Finland will turn to be 100 years old as a nation next year. 2017 is a big celebration in the whole country. So obviously, we use that as an element in the bid. So kind of the key learning here is if you have something sort of a bigger theme than your event is in the society in the upcoming years, try to connect your bid with that. So that will obviously give you an edge. Use it as a competitive advantage or such. And also what we learned afterwards is that it will give you actually a lot of tools in developing your event, because you have an kind of a given overarching theme that you can work with. Jumping to your next question is, one more key learning. Do a very, very thorough work with the organizing agreements before you bid. So everything should fall into place, every small detail about the roles and responsibilities, whether it's a financial or another kind of a role, should be very, very clear before you do any kind of biddings. Because after the bid, the stage is set, and then if there's any kind of internal competition or not clear roles within the organizer, then it gets really difficult and you waste a lot of energy when you should be planning the event, actually. So, but jumping into the next thing about our event is that I think it's quite common in all sort of in sports athletes that the international federations have a certain structure and a sort of set of rules when it comes to major events. What I've learned so far is that those rules basically concentrate around the TV product and the fulfilling of different technical issues concerning the sport. So it's kind of inside the ropes booklet of rules, which is a very thorough and it's a good tool. But I claim that in the modern world, if you look at the modern customer behavior and the needs and wants of any of us, using our leisure time, paying money for it, actually, you have to buy a ticket, it's not enough to only concentrate your organizing of an event around that booklet of rules. So turning the eye towards the guests, which are not only the people who buy a ticket, it's everybody who attends your event, it's the media, it's the B2C guests, B2B guests, the athletes, the teams, the volunteers, your own staff, everybody. So what we did is we spent a lot of time. Of course, you have to have the fulfill the international rules. So that should be a sort of a given. It's, if you can call it, maybe a, it should be a kind of a commodity in your organizing. It must be there and taken care of. But turning the eye to the other side, outside the ropes, what kind of visitor experience or guest experience are we able to create for those people that actually are one of the most important groups? Because then jumping shortly into the legacy, because you want to create loyalty towards your city, towards your event, towards your whatever your goal is. So you want them to come back, and going back again into the modern society where we've jumped from the service economy into a experience economy, and then whatever the next stage is, transformation economy or whatever it's called at the current time. So that has been a thing that we have been concentrating a lot in, and the difficulty in this major event is that it's a one-off. You don't really have a learning curve. You don't do it every year. So it's been a really, really exciting experience to design that.
And word design actually is a very key for us. We have used a lot of service design processes to design the path of individual guests, groups, basically segments within the visitors. Being maybe the five more important is, of course, the families containing the youth, and then sort of middle-aged groups of people who come there more to party than to maybe watch the events. And then, of course, the elderly, pensionists who have actually a lot of money nowadays, a very important group of customers, etc. So what we have done is we have very carefully segmented the visitors that will attend our event. We can use digital tools nowadays to find out about your customers, because you have to know what they want if you want to then serve them sort of so that they are satisfied in the end or exceed expectation, as was mentioned here yesterday very clearly. So and then another thing, when you find out about your most important group of people attending and those segments, then if you can, and what we are trying to do is to sort of mass customize the event so that all those major segments have their own kind of experience during the day or a couple of days that they spend in the event, because it is clear that the family of four with small kids or an elderly person, they don't want to necessarily to experience their day in each other's company, because it might be a disruptive thing. There's maybe a party going on in a festival hall, and then the family with kids, they don't want to be there. They want to spend their day in a suitable way for a family. So using service design processes to sort of create different paths for different segments of visitors within the area has been very much in our focus. And we don't know if it's going to work, but we really try to create that kind of new experience. So basically, summarizing, you get the set of rules from the International Federation, but those contain the sport element very much. And who will eventually take care of the customer experience? It's the organizer. But you need a new kind of skill set, a new kind of ideas to do that. Otherwise, I think you will be below par, or yeah, golf terms, making a bogey in that segment. And that will not be enough anymore for the current customers, because the expectations are high.
Thanks very much. Ian, riding on the coattails of tremendously successful Commonwealth Games in 2014, can you speak a little bit to the concept of the strategy that you've developed locally and how that fits into kind of a long-term perspective for the city of Glasgow?
Yeah, thanks. Yes, I can. I suppose Commonwealth Games was a big moment for Glasgow and Scotland in 2014, and the decision to bid for the Games in 2003, because this is one of the world's bigger multi-sport events in terms of money, in terms of just size, scale, and complexity, was a big decision financially, if nothing else, for the Scottish Government and the City of Glasgow. So the fundamental question, I suppose, was, well, why? And that why question about why are we bidding for this event? Why do we want to stage this event? Is something that we now continually ask ourselves when we look at events in the city. And maybe we did before that, but because just the sheer scale of the Commonwealth Games, we had to seriously ask ourselves why. And then, having answered that question, how do we make that legacy happen through the Commonwealth Games? So it was very much about how can we make this major event in Glasgow in 2014 advance what we want to do as a city in terms of our social strategies, our health strategies, our economic strategies, and our sporting strategies as well, and tourism. So when we won the Games in 2007, still 6 years before, or 7 years before we were staging the event, we had in place our legacy plan. It wasn't an outline plan. It was a very detailed action plan split into five themes. One of them was around transport and infrastructure, as we've just heard from our colleague in FIFA, with many of the same aspirations about trying to move people from cars to public transport and cycling. One of them was about making the city healthier and more active through sport and sports development. One of them was about business development and economic development. One about being a greener and more sustainable city. And we had a whole series of actions, key performance indicators, a whole monitoring and evaluation, governance arrangements around the implementation and execution of that legacy plan through the organising committee in the detailed planning of the event. And that was the tricky part. You know, easy enough to develop the plan, easy enough to make it aligned to what we want to do in overall economic and social terms and regeneration terms as a city. But how do we make the organising company for the Commonwealth Games actually make decisions? Because you can make many different types of decisions where we through the governance arrangements and the influence that we had through the Scottish Government and the city, I suppose we encouraged the organising company for the Games itself to make decisions that were as much about legacy or even more about legacy and meeting the aims in that plan than they were necessarily about how we staged the event in 2014, mindful of how we staged the event in 2014. So some, you know, it really affected our venue planning, for example. You know, there were certain thoughts about how we could cost-effectively put up temporary structures. And then we said, not for legacy terms, there are one or two things here where we want to see something developed for the longer term. So we tried to develop business plans for all our venue developments. We had a master plan that really fitted in with the different communities around the city in terms of where we wanted the event staged. So therefore, it wasn't quite as compact as, say, an Olympic Park, because it wasn't just about the staging of the event in 2014. You know, the key question is the day after. What are we trying to achieve in the longer term? So as I say, it affected and influenced that plan, every decision that was made, I would argue. So even things like our ticketing strategy, you know, we had lower pricing, concessionary pricing, because it was meant to be an inclusive Games, because we're trying to get people inspired through the event. You know, Glasgow's a city that has its more than its fair share of people on low incomes and in poverty. We didn't want them excluded from the event. We wanted them to be participants in terms of spectators at the event. So everywhere was full. You know, our venues were, you know, qualifying events, some of the lower profile events, which I never really expected to have full stadia or full arenas or full venues, were full from morning to night for the 12 days of the event. It was fantastic and a real inspiration. And the surveys that we've done since the Games are over, one of the biggest outcomes was the pride that the citizens had in being involved in the Commonwealth Games and the inspiration that has had in terms of them becoming more active citizens. So I suppose we're now shifting that plan as we look forward to 2018 and the European Championships in 2018. Another major multi-sport event being held for the first time in Glasgow. We're trying to make sure that that plan continues. We have to evolve that plan, change that plan. But again, we're making sure that every decision leading up to 2018 is influenced by what we want to achieve in the longer term. So it's about an approach that we're trying to take to both deciding what events to stage in this city and then how we approach the planning of those events with the longer term in view.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I think all of us who are involved in the industry understand is the critical role that volunteers play in hosting the events. And really, over the last couple of days, we haven't heard a lot about volunteers, but they're the lifeblood, really, of events. None of us would be here without volunteers, I would think it'd be fair to say. Can you speak to, perhaps, Jani, what your approach is in, you know, with the World Nordic Ski Championships in terms of recruiting and training those volunteers
and then acknowledging their significant contributions to the event.
Yes, I think we found a good way to encourage new volunteers. So basically, in a traditional way, the volunteers come in, they work, they get a jacket, they get a handshake, and then they, of course, it's a social thing, they enjoy that. And there's that kind of background to the volunteer work, which is great. But I think maybe that needs to be kind of reshaped a little bit. And what we did is, because we have a very customer-oriented approach for the first time in a major event, at least in Finland, so we needed to make sure that all the volunteers go through a customer training program, customer service program. And because we are not ourselves professionals in that field, we are organizers. So we tried to figure out who is the best force in our country to take care of that. So it turned out it's a labor union for the service industry. So we invited it's actually the biggest single labor union in Finland with about, I don't know, 500,000 members or so. And we proposed to them that why don't you design a customer service program for our volunteers and then you become our partner. And you can tell the story in your channels and make a good story about that. And then we get, as a counter service, we get then the training program. And they said, wow, yeah, great, let's do that. And so look outside your box, find out the best forces, understand what you can do, and then understand also what you cannot do and get help from outside. Use the best forces in your region or in the country. And now what our volunteers get, everybody goes through the program. They get the certified diploma or whatever it's called that they have done this program, and then it's a great asset especially for the younger volunteers in their CV on applying for a job in the future. So it is the event experience, the social experience, and there's the jacket and there's the hat and everything. But there's also the customer service program that they go through, which is a great asset. So looking into new fields and try to give them a little bit more than they got before. So that worked very well so far.
Yeah, Ian?
Yeah, we challenged ourselves in volunteering. We didn't approach it in the most straightforward of ways for the Commonwealth Games. So, as with previous Commonwealth Games and other major events, we were oversubscribed with applications for volunteers. But they came from the traditional places. They came from almost international volunteers that move from event to event, sports club volunteers are very much involved in the sport, and maybe people from generally more affluent backgrounds that were interested in just volunteering, coming from all parts of the UK as well as Glasgow. But in some respects, that was disappointing to us because we felt that wasn't engaging with a large part of the population in Glasgow who come from different minority communities, who come from low-income families, some of them are homeless and unemployed. And we wanted to make sure that everyone in Glasgow was encouraged and had the opportunity to volunteer. So we created the Host City Volunteer Programme, specially designed to work with partner agencies to encourage those that don't normally volunteer ever to be engaged. And we engaged nearly 2,000 volunteers from those communities. And we've continued to engage those volunteers for other events. So recently we staged the Homeless World Cup. Using the same approach, a fair share of the volunteers for our Homeless World Cup were homeless people. It provided all sorts of challenges around training, around retention, but it was worthwhile, and the atmosphere that added to the event, as it did with the Commonwealth Games, was really significant and very rewarding. But again, it's all part of that social regeneration plan that we have for the longer term for Glasgow.
Just a reminder that this is more of a town hall session. So if there's any questions at any point, or you'd like to make a comment based on Ben's intro there, feel free to do so. We've got microphones here that can help. One of the things I think that also we all recognize is that it's not all roses. And you would get the impression over the last couple of days that, oh my God, what a great industry to be involved in. You know, there's no downside. Well, clearly that's not the case. And so, you know, I thought we'd kind of challenge the what's left of our panel here to speak to perhaps some of the events that they've been involved with that maybe didn't turn out so well, or in a bid process that perhaps you weren't successful. You know, in our case in Canada, we've got a formula. It's something in the neighborhood of if you're successful in one of four bids that you put forward, you're doing pretty good. Like that's 25%. And you know, with the bidding environment now, as ultra competitive as it is, and the opportunity costs that are involved, somewhat in some cases astronomical opportunity costs with no guarantee of a positive outcome at the end, what we're left with is what are the learnings for the next time around? So maybe, Yanni, can you kind of start?
Yeah, I mean, generally, there should be a... When you enter the process of bidding, to sort of try to make sure that it's a learning process that will, in the end, give out a positive outcome in some form. If it's a learning, if it's a new way of organizing yourself within the region or in the city or within the country, or something. So also that the bidding process would have a sort of a mini legacy in itself, because then you are not so disappointed in the end if you don't get the games or if you get them on the fourth time. That's good. But what I'm trying to say here is that if you just kind of always start over, and then that organization, the people and the network that was involved in the bidding sort of is dissolved, and all the learnings is kind of thrown out of the window. That's a waste of time and money, right? So we are looking into that a little bit in Finland now, where there is not really a national level bidding strategy for major events due to many reasons, due to the organization of the National Olympic Committee and so forth. There's an ongoing process, but we should try to create a new model there that would contain this ideology, in my opinion, that the bidding process in itself is a valuable learning process, and there should be a learning curve, and that should be used for some purpose, whether you get the games or not.
Mm-hmm. Ian?
Yeah, we had a failed Youth Olympic Games bid because we bid for the Youth Olympic Games for 2018. And I suppose, I'm not sure, but we had some learnings around that. I suppose the main learning was, in some respects, although as a city we have a good record in terms of bidding for Commonwealth Games and individual sporting events, the main learning was the IOC and an IOC product. You enter into a different, you know, we entered into a different, completely different field of, I suppose, politics, another level that I'm not sure we were ready for. I'm probably a little naive about the technical bid, tremendous, but not sure it counted for an awful lot at the time when the decision was made about the Youth Olympic Games. There were lots of things happening. It was the IOC presidency. It was the decisions around the 2020 Olympics, which finally went to Tokyo. There were issues around which sports were coming in and coming out of the Olympic, and numerous other things that that completely dictated where the votes went. And we sort of understood some of that, but didn't fully understand what was going on. We've tried to get a legacy out of that in terms of we've created a year of young people for 2018. Probably the best outcome we had from that failed bid was we're now doing the European Championships in 2018, which is an opportunity that came out of the failure of that event. And we're really excited about that in 2018. And we feel far more involved in creating something new with our partners, the European Sports Federations, and Berlin, our other major partner. So it feels like something that, you know, we're shaping. There is no rule book. There's not even an inside the ropes book for this one or an Outside the Ropes, we're actually creating it as an entirely fresh concept. And that really is exciting. So in some respects, what came out of the demise of our Youth Olympic Games bid has, I think, been to our benefit ultimately, although it wasn't planned that way at the time.
Yeah, in many cases, after a bid process is concluded and the winning bid is selected, rights holders will often hold it's almost like a post-mortem, review process with the unsuccessful bidders. And there's a lot of key learnings that can be gleaned from that process as well.
Well, interestingly enough, Agenda 2020 came out soon after the Youth Olympic Games process and for 2018. And, you know, there's a lot of good rhetoric in Agenda 2020 and good principles. It's all down to implementation and action.
We've had our share, I guess, of unsuccessful bids or bids that didn't turn out quite the way we had expected. And I think one of them was the Commonwealth Games bid, which eventually went to Glasgow, which, we conducted a domestic bidding process in Canada, and Halifax was designated as the Canadian bid to go forward. Well, interestingly enough, there was a municipal election in between, and the entire council was replaced and turfed. And the new council had a different perspective in terms of moving forward, and that's when the bid died. And this is another Commonwealth Games example. I don't know. I'm not sure if it's related or there's a common thread here. But with the Edmonton bid for 2022, totally different set of circumstances. But with the falling price of oil internationally in the Alberta economy, basically relying on the industry, the oil industry, to generate up to 60% of its operating revenue, it was an easy decision there as well. But those are kind of elements that are outside of the direct control of, the bid committee that can have a negative effect. Is there anyone else who would like to share an unsuccessful bid story? Well, no one has had an unsuccessful bid. That's great. Wow. Good group.
I think one big thing, looking at not only sporting but conferences, the value of putting money on the table is a complicated thing nowadays. Come to the table, Hong Kong, come to the table, very strong with cash. We've lost a couple, but we win a lot as well. This is something I see the future is going to, it's going to come down to quality, as Glasgow was saying about, and you're saying about what the destination gives. This model is going to have to change, and I think it is changing worldwide. We've lost bids because we do not pay to play. It's the way we see it. It's a complicated thing, and I think slowly but surely, this will change over the next couple of years. This, for me, is the one thing that it's an unfair advantage. We all do the same mathematics. We all do the math, how much it's going to generate as revenue. But cities coming in and putting cash on the table, what we've noticed over the last couple of years, international conferences and congresses especially, the entities aren't liking this anymore. It's almost becoming a no play.
Mm-hmm. Ian?
Yeah, I don't know if the balance is shifting. I hope it is. There are less cities seem to be interested in future Olympic Games. Does that make rights holders think about what are we trying to achieve? And can they get a better balance with the interests of stakeholders, particularly cities? One of the interesting things about the compilation of 2020, Agenda 2020, the one stakeholder that wasn't properly consulted were cities. So there's a lot of discussion with sponsors, with international sports federations, with national Olympic committees, cities actually weren't a major consultation partner in developing Agenda 2020. I think that's got to change. I think cities have got to be seen as a major stakeholder here, otherwise they won't play. It's interesting, particularly in Europe, but actually in Canada as well, because Halifax was really not only an issue of the council, but actually there was a growing negativity amongst the public, I think, in Halifax towards the Commonwealth Games bid. We've heard about the public referendums in a number of cities in Germany and Europe. So you've got to get people on board and you've got to get cities on board, and the interests of cities have got to be taken a little bit more seriously. They're not just going to throw money at events without any rationale.
Anyone else? Maybe one of the last, we've only got a few minutes left, but one of the last things we might want to talk about a little bit is what are the trends maybe that we're seeing in the area of bidding and hosting? You know, one issue that I think affects all of us is, you know, the high, you know, rights fees or associated fees that are associated with a lot of these events. In our case, we had a bad experience with the FINA 2005 World Aquatic Championships in Montreal that we hosted in Montreal. If some of you remember, it was, you know, the rights were gained by Montreal. They were given to Montreal. They were taken away. They were, you know, given back at, you know, at the 11th hour. You know, and that event, although it was a tremendous success from a competitive standpoint and from a spectator perspective, it was not quite as successful from a financial perspective. From a budget standpoint, that event lost about $6 million. And it was one of the requirements, of course, was the deficit guarantee that most of the IFs have in place now in their agreements. I think for the most part, you know, it's kind of a one-way agreement these days. And I think, you know, is the landscape moving more toward a collaborative hosting approach? And is that even possible given where we are today? Yanni?
Yeah, I think it is, because what we've seen in our case and the experience very fresh is that the environment to host events is not necessarily getting easier. There are the different kind of set of rules or even the laws concerning, for example, that comes from the rescue service or the police force, how many people can attend an event. And there's all kinds of regulations and rules. Maybe Finland is bad in bureaucracy. I don't know about other countries, but it certainly needs to, for us at least, to be competitive in the future, it needs a nationwide strategy where everybody should collaborate, whether it's the different offices of the government taking care of different things, whether it's the infrastructure or those rules and laws and regulations that I mentioned before. So also TV production, you know, which is the national TV company, which is owned by the state, no longer does the host broadcast and the production of the signal free of charge. So we have to pay for it. So you're kind of squeezed financially, you're squeezed by the rules and regulations, and there should be a counter sort of lobbying movement from the side of the events and maybe the host cities as well to turn the table to more favorable situation for the future. That's at least my very fresh experience.
Mm-hmm. Ian, any thoughts?
I mean, I definitely think there needs to be a more collaborative approach. I suppose I've spoken about that already. As I say, it's really refreshing with the European Championships in 2018 that we have a board of international sports federations, broadcasters and cities sitting together thinking about both the championships in 2018 and the longer term future. And it truly feels like a collaboration, even more so than the Commonwealth Games, where the CGF played and the Commonwealth Games Federation played the normal role of rights holder. It was just, it just feels different with the way we're planning it for 2018. And it really is interesting the way that's developing, because it is a slightly different approach.
I mean, one of the trends that we're seeing significantly, I would say, in Canada is the dual hosting model. And the ability to partner with another city, whether it's close or far. In Canada, we have four and a half time zones. It's a little bit more difficult that way. But for events like the World Junior Hockey Championships, which is a huge event in Canada, they've had to move into NHL arenas simply because of the capacity issues, and into you know, two different cities with NHL arenas. So, for example, next month that event is being held for the second time in 3 years in Montreal and Toronto, and they're playing out of, you know, NHL size arenas that seat 18,000 plus. And that model has been in place for several years now in Canada. And I think one of the elements within Agenda 2020 speaks to that, right? Yeah. It gets you access to certainly double the infrastructure, double the municipal funding base, volunteers, different media markets, etc.
I think there's, but there's a real added value. I mean, we have a partnership now with Berlin with 2018. Yes, there are practical approaches. I'm going to have a common approach to medals and ceremonies and look and feel and the one medals table. And it will seem seamless as you go back from Glasgow to Berlin between the different, between swimming and athletics or whatever, through the TV broadcasts. But I suppose that's just common sense, and that's what you'd expect to happen. The added value is the partnership behind the scenes between two cities in Europe. So the cultural exchange, the development of ideas and innovation between two cities that's now taking place, the links between two city governments that are now taking place in between politicians, between business leaders. So that throws that up as an opportunity. So I think it's definitely the direction of travel. I think pure economics is going to force this as a way forward. And you're right, it's been recognised in Agenda 2020. But I think we'll see this increasingly, in certainly in the mega events, where, you know, yeah.
Any questions from the audience?
We started today talking about the experience of the spectator. I'm just interested in what people's views are. If we go to this multi-city, multi-nation approach, how do we ensure that that spectator experience is still at the top level of everybody's priorities, and it's managed in a way that is new but consistent across different nations? I'm just thinking of a football supporter who goes to Paris for one match and Athens for another. That's a really expensive trip. So how do we start to, how do we have those two priorities and manage to satisfy both parties?
You want to take a crack at that, Ian?
Very good. Well, I think you've raised a really interesting issue, which is the spectator experience, because remarkably, sometimes I think it's almost overlooked, as and we would view that as a key and number one priority. So creating the atmosphere in the venue, prioritising the customer journey for the spectator is really, really crucial. Yes, it's slightly more challenging when you've got that across two cities. I'm not necessarily advocating you do it far more than that. We have direct flights between Berlin and Glasgow. There are many of them daily between Scotland and Berlin. So, you know, there are ways of constructing ticketing packages that enable spectators to move from athletics in Berlin to the other sports in Glasgow. And we are carefully looking at that. But there's the spectator experience within both cities is also crucially important. How do we create that atmosphere in the venue? And there's all sorts of different ways of doing that.
Talking about the customer experience, I mean, the oldest rule in business is that you should know your customer. And how many sporting events claim that they really know who their customers are in the first place, where they live, how do they spend their time, what do they want? So I think the new digital tools give a great opportunity in the future for sporting events or any events actually to get tap into that field that has been never touched before, at least in our country. In the city, the host city of Lahti, there has been these events organized for almost 100 years. And I started in this process 3 years ago, and there was not one name or email address or phone number or any kind of information of any of the people who visited any of the events before. So first, I mean, we should use the tools that are existing now in the market to get to know the people that are supposed to be our guests, and then try to shape the experience in the way they want. And there's a division. First, you can assume something by the information that you get, and then there's the blue ocean. Maybe some new things that nobody even knows about that should be there that you can experiment with, you know, for example, virtual reality, whatever, you know, whatever the future brings. So, but I think we should really look into the knowing our customers and then shaping the product after that, and not vice versa, because then we are assuming something and people might not like it.
Very good. Any other comments, questions? If not, we've got about 2 minutes left. This is going to be a real quick hitter. So I'd ask each of you to, on the topic of transfer of knowledge, okay, this is an area that in Canada we host over 45 to 50 international sport events a year, but we fail miserably in this area of transfer of knowledge. And it's one of our priorities, actually, to try to fix that. Can you just give a quick perspective, perhaps starting with you, Ian, in terms of what your approach to transfer of knowledge is from one event to the other, or does it exist at all?
Well, it does exist, and clearly Commonwealth Games has a very very formal transfer of knowledge program. Within Glasgow, we have one city events team, so it makes some respects a little easier to ensure that the lessons we learn, both good and bad, from one major event to another, are transferred. I think one of the difficulties, because with transfer, there are some good transfer of knowledge programs, so I don't necessarily feel that it's always missing transfer of knowledge, but some people don't listen. You know, so even when the knowledge is transferred, are the recipients actually listening to what's happening here? And that's not always the case. So, you know, so don't always blame necessarily the absence of a transfer of knowledge program.
Ian?
Yeah, it's a big problem. The way we try to tackle that in our project is that we established a company instead of doing it by in the LOC there are three parties, and then after the games the LOC is dissolved, and then all the knowledge is thrown out the window and it vanishes. But when there's a company, there's an interest from somebody who owns the company to invest in that company and raise the level of awareness and develop skills and create platforms to gather information. So it should be a strategically led process to gather information and use that information for future purposes. But first it needs to be led from somewhere from the top, whether it's a governmental or a local or inner city or whatever decision, what kind of knowledge is gathered and how is it used and for what and for whose purpose. So otherwise, you are just lost and, money and energy is lost and thrown out.
Okay, so please join me in thanking our panelists.
Thank you very much to the panel and to all participants in Host City 2016. Thank you very much for joining us. I'd just like to say one last thing on the subject of listening to knowledge. All of the audio of the panel sessions is available on, you can actually find it on iTunes, I've just been told. So if you just search for Host City on iTunes and you'll be able to find the audio of the panels. Thanks once again and hope to see you next time. All the best.